Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for tuning into The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It is Wednesday, June 12th. Today we survey the news media landscape in Hawaii. Much has changed recently, but are the changes for the better? We hear from the Media Council of Hawaii. Traffic congestion costs us all the time in productivity, so can congestion pricing help thin out crowded highways? We take a closer look on the long view. 4 years ago, the city and state sued the gas and oil industry over climate change. Will the U.S. Supreme Court take up the case later this year? From operating the state's last coal-fired plant to opening the state's largest solar project on Maui, we learn what's next for AES Hawaii. And call the midwife, or maybe not, waiting for a decision that affects midwifery here in the islands. The conversation starts right after the latest headlines. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Look out on the shrinking news media landscape, and it's not a pretty picture. We talked to the Hawaii Media Council recently to reflect on the state of journalism across Hawaii. Gerald Kato is a retired University of Hawaii journalism professor. He's also a veteran print and broadcast journalist. And full disclosure, he and I once worked together at the ABC affiliate, KITV. We sat down in our studio recently to talk about recent changes on the local and national scene and why you should care.
A lot of media in town have changed hands. They've shrunk. They've disappeared. Sadly, in the intervening time, we've seen the Hawaii Hochi and the Hawaii Herald go out of business. These star advertisers changed hands to a company based in Mississippi, I believe. And a reminder that Oahu Publications, the owner of the Star Advertiser, also owns the Garden Island, Hawaii Tribune Herald, and the West Hawaii Today, which West Hawaii Today, I understand, has gotten rid of all its reporters. I'm not quite sure how they're covering West Hawaii.
Yeah, Kona news, right? And stuff happens in Kona.
Yeah, a lot happens in Kona, and a lot has happened in Maui. And look what's happened to the Maui news. It's become a shadow of the vibrant newspaper it once was that covered the community. And this is at a time when the community needs a strong and vibrant newspaper, because after the fire, the rebuilding process is going to take years. And what do we have? You know, the Maui News is shrinking, literally shrinking, to being published once a week. Arguably, that they're all going online. But their population that reads the newspaper tends to be older, and there is a cohort there that simply doesn't go online.
And then we saw some other developments as well. I believe the Star Advertiser has ended its relationship with Associated Press, and they had, a couple of boots on the ground, local reporters covering things and writing stories. And so that was a bit of a head-scratcher to see that relationship disappear. But then I believe AP is now hooked up with Honolulu Civil Beat.
Yeah, and I hope that relation thrives, but that is a sad turn of events, because I think the AP was a major source of news to supplement what the Star Advertiser had. And the Star Advertiser, they may not admit it, but they're shrinking. I mean, shrinking, literally. The staff is shrinking, and I would not be surprised that they go the route of Maui News and maybe publish less frequently. Already, they don't publish on Saturday. And, I was reminded that the Mitsunaga Kaneshiro decision, their acquittal, happened on a Friday. So that story appeared in the Star Advertiser. For the Star Advertiser readers, you could only access it online.
Right. And if you don't go online, you don't see the story. It
didn't happen. You don't see the story, yeah. I don't think the people in the newsroom at the Star Advertiser really know or fully understand the dimensions of the change in ownership, what that means and what that holds for the future. As I understand it, I don't think the new management has really talked in the newsroom about what the future holds. Interestingly enough, I was reading a a story today about the Washington Post, which in the past few days got rid of its editor-in-chief and brought in a new crew of people for a reorganization of the newspaper. At the very least, I guess, the new editorial team, the managers and the publisher, had a staff meeting. And I suppose this goes to why publishers and executives don't like meeting with the newsroom. It didn't go well for the publisher because there are a lot of questions about what the future is, what the future of the Washington Post is, what the future of journalism holds for a proud newspaper like the Washington Post. And the answers the newsroom got, at least, were not promising. We're not really filled them in with a lot of information on what that future is going to be.
Well, and even just newsrooms these days, I mean, I remember reading about how, I think it was the Chicago Tribune, was outsourcing the obits to an outfit in the Philippines, where they were not actually boots on the ground in that community. They were overseas, and they were just aggregating information and spitting out obits, which was pretty shocking.
Well, I think the obits, even at the Star Advertiser, is outsourced. I'm not quite sure whether it's in the Philippines just yet, but it's run by another website.
Just over the many decades, news as we knew it growing up has just changed so much.
Sure, the local connection has been lost. Newspapers, media are owned by people outside of Hawaii, and they have little or no connection to Hawaii. There are a lot less resources devoted to covering the community. That community connection, I think, gets lost. And it's not surprising to me that I think there is a relationship with that loss of connection between newspapers and news organizations in the community, and this kind of disengagement you see in the community as reflected in the people running for office. There was a report out that the number of competitive seats in Hawaii, but it's the lowest in 10 years. Many important offices just go without any kind of challenge. City council, I think the mayor has nominal opposition. I'm sure for the incumbents, they love that, but it's not really healthy for democracy. And I think part of that is due to this lack of community engagement. I think when there were two thriving newspapers or a lot of competitive media in Hawaii, there was a lot more engagement with what was going on in the community, politically, commercially. You know, the people were a lot more involved with what was going on. They weren't retreating to their computers.
Reading the headlines, I believe it was in New York, where they were giving tax credits to organizations in an effort to boost journalism. But I don't know, do you see that as a viable strategy?
I think it's a viable strategy, a limited strategy, I think. One of the reasons independent journalism thrived was that there was a business model that provided support independent from government and provided that kind of free press that we needed and wanted. But public needs to realize that the old cliche of free press is not free. You've got to be willing to pay for quality journalism. It's not cheap. And a recent study showed that a lot of people don't like paying. They think that they should access the news for free. You know, none of these paywalls or anything like that. And arguably, I can see the idea that, well, you know, people should have greater access to news and information, but it's an expensive process. I mean, somebody has to pay for it. And I think if the public really wants quality journals, they ought to be willing to pay for quality work, whether it's in newspapers, online, the radio, television. People ought to be able to support good journalism. When I say good journalism, by the way, I mean reporters who will go out and look for facts, verifiable facts, not alternative facts, but verifiable information. That's what good journalism is all about. And it doesn't matter whether it's newspapers or radio or online, but good, reliable facts. Unfortunately, the most popular national television programs tend to be on Fox and MSNBC, both of which are not shy about sharing their opinions. And there's a place for opinions, but opinions are cheap. Fact-based journalism is expensive.
Yeah, so what are we to do?
Well, I'm not sure. I'm often befuddled by this, by what to do next. It looks pretty dire out there for newspapers, for one thing. And I'm sad about that. You know, I started my career as a newspaper man. I love newspapers. But it's pretty clear that newspapers are not going to survive. There was a study once about 20 years ago by Phil Meyer, a professor in North Carolina. And he predicted that newspapers will die out completely in the first quarter of 2043. I suspect that that timeline is maybe too far out. That by the end of the decade, we probably won't see a newspaper.
Yeah, so it comes sooner than
here
later.
Here in Hawaii, anyway. I think maybe the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and some of the bigger newspapers will still publish, but a lot of the smaller newspapers won't be around. And I'm concerned about communities, not only here in Oahu, but what about Kauai? What about Maui? What about the Big Island? You know, what and how will they get news and information about their community? There needs to be some new models. I guess there's some talk about starting up an online news operation on Maui. I hope it works. But again, you know, people have to want reliable, verifiable information.
They have to support it.
They have to support it. And, you know, if all they want is opinions, opinion is cheap. You could get anybody's opinion for nothing.
Yeah. And then going back to the idea that we're watchdogs and there are fewer watchdogs out there watching.
Yeah. No, a lot fewer. A lot fewer than certainly when we were beat reporters. You know, I used to complain when I first started off in journalism. I worked at a paper in California for a while. And they would send me to, like, the water board and the school board. And Lord knows, I had to cover the Daughters of American Revolution once, way back when. but you know, I think back now that, wow, you know, we did all of these stories. In their totality, they reflected the community in which we lived in. I mean, you know, people were informed about what was going on with various boards and commissions. Not only that, but one of the requirements when I was a young reporter was that if you go to the school board or you go to the city council and they want to do a executive session, a secret meeting, you raise your hand and you make sure that they follow whatever the open meetings laws were in California and Hawaii, that they declare why they were going into an executive session. And they take a vote.
Yeah, call them on it. Yeah.
And call them on it. Mm-hmm. And nowadays, there's nobody there.
Any final thoughts just about where we're at and where we need to go?
We certainly are in a time when we need more and better information. We have truckloads of information, not always reliable information. A lot of misinformation and disinformation out there, by the way. We need to demand better of our news organizations. We need to demand better of our schools in terms of media literacy, news literacy, having a better understanding of why news and information is so important to a thriving democracy.
Jerry Kato, thank you so much. I appreciate you coming down here.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to chat.
That was Gerald Kato, former print and broadcast journalist and retired journalism professor at the University of Hawaii. He's with the Hawaii Media Council and was talking with us about the state of journalism across the islands and the country.
Support for HPR comes from the Office of Hawaiian Affairs, committed to supporting Native Hawaiian homeowners and renters impacted by the Maui wildfires. More about its Kanaho grant at oha.org/kanaho grant.
This week's performance at HPR's Hawaii Jazz Performance Series has sold out. Mahalo for your support. Watch videos from past HPR concerts and sign up for email alerts for future performances. Visit hawaiipublicradio.org, sponsored by Farm Lovers Markets.
Residents are very familiar with the frustrations that come with traffic congestion. Did you know that the annual cost of that congestion is nearly $700 million in lost time and productivity? Congestion pricing is something that's being considered as a way to reduce heavy traffic, and that is the topic for the Longview today. Here to talk about that is contributing editor Neil Milner. Good morning.
Hi. I probably cost about $1 million just trying to get down Kapi'olani.
Yes.
That's, they do their share.
Well, now, so New York was at the front of the line with this congestion pricing idea, and it's on pause.
Yeah, it's, well, pause is a nice way to put it, and we'll get to New York in a second, because as we speak, New York should have had the system running, and they don't. It was canceled. And why that was, we'll get to in a second. But I want to make sure people understand what we're talking about. As you said, congestion, traffic congestion, costs a lot of money. That's and this is a reliable study by UHERO, the economic research operation. One of the ways that certain cities have tried to deal with it, and economists like this idea, is through what's called congestion pricing. What it means is that if you drive a vehicle on certain streets, designated streets, during what would be the rush hour, you're going to pay a tariff for that. And the basic argument, never mind externalities and internalities, the basic argument is, hey, you're contributing more to the cost, you should pay. And so that's essentially what congested pricing is. There are a few cities around the world that have tried it and continue to have it. Stockholm, London, I think Singapore has it. So let's look at what happened in New York, because this is a very appealing concept to economists. It's not always very appealing to the average citizen, because for an economist, it's an elegant theory that would explain a lot and collect money. For the average citizen, it's a kind of deferred gratification. You're paying this money in out of your pocket, and the benefits that you may see from this are down the road. So that brings us up to New York. New York City is, as we'll see, a very special case. The thing that makes it most special is the extensive and actually quite good subway system that has a ridership that no other city in the country comes close to competing with. So on and off during the years, there has been attempts to introduce congested pricing into New York City, particularly sections of Manhattan. And again, the way it would work is you'd pay some kind of toll and it would be monitored. It never got very far. Various mayors tried to get it. And then a few years ago, it looked as if it was going to go forward. It did go forward, probably as much because the revenue was supposed to go to help rebuild the subway system. So the subway system is very extensive. It needs a whole lot of maintenance. And what that means, people who watch television about subways think the problem is crime. It's not crime. The problem is the service gets bad because they're always fixing stuff. So the deal was, the political deal was to the public, look, we're not just creating a disincentive. The disincentive is you have to pay to drive the thing. We're going to create an incentive by using this money to rebuild the system so that you would have lots of ways to use it. Went forward. Everybody expected it. And to work, it was passed. They spent $500 million to put the toll system into place. And then, what is it, 2 weeks ago at the most, with absolutely no warning, the governor of New York said, we're not doing it. It's canceled. And she said, this is not a good time to make people spend more money out of their pockets. Well, the thing is that this was done so suddenly and with such fixed costs already in there that you wonder what was going on. One of the things that was going on was that the Democratic governor and the congressional Democrats are worried about Republican inroads in certain areas of Long Island that are fairly competitive. And there's been a little bit more anti-rail sentiment from there. Political conservatives are a little more doubtful about this kind of operation. That seemed to be part of it. And she made this kind of bread and butter argument, but it sounds so actually lame so late in the game. So now various bad things have happened. I'm spending some time on this because I want to see what kind of lessons it has. So what you have now is you don't have the system, so you'll have the same kind of congestion. You won't have as much money to fix the subway system because this was going to contribute a chunk of money to that. So now you're pretty much nowhere. And some of the lessons here are, even though in New York you had a bargaining chip, you could say we already have an extensive system and you're going to give us money to make it
better,
to improve
right?
it better. Yeah, which is a problem with a lot of smaller subway systems. They never have enough maintenance money and they wait too long. Okay, so this is, so it makes me take a closer look at what these systems are like and what it would be like if you try to do it in Hawaii. It's come up in Hawaii before. The economists here, some of the economists have been very positive toward it. About you could have some kind of monitoring system that could be extensive, exist all the time, so that depending on when you drove, you would pay more or less money. It hasn't gotten much traction here, I think for a lot of reasons. But one of the reasons is that we're very car-oriented. Mm-hmm. We don't have an extensive public transit system that's anywhere close to New York, and we don't have the congestion or the enormous parking costs that they have in New York. Most people don't drive into New York City
right.
for work. It's just it's too expensive. So, and if you think about the bargain that congested pricing could offer in New York, it wasn't enough to finally get it through. We can't argue that we already have an extensive rail system. We have a pretty good bus system. Yeah, right.
We barely have a rail system.
Who's gonna buy into the fact that if you put more money in it? So it looks very different here. It looks like it's not likely to happen. But the fundamental problem with these things is how you try to get them to go, how you get them started, and most of all, this deferred gratification thing. Some cities have been able to get them started pretty easily. London was. Stockholm was very careful. They did studies, and then they agreed to have a referendum on whether to have congested pricing. All the referendum said is it'll exist for 7 months, and then we'll evaluate it. This is not anything that New York did. But again, you have to remember how hard it is to bring about extensive changes in behavior when essentially you're paying for this up front, but it's not going to, the benefits aren't going to happen until later.
Yeah, no, and it's hard. And when we had Ed Sniffen here, the transportation director, yeah. we talked about that. And I said, well, I feel for the people on the west side because rail was supposed to give them the option and we don't have rail yet. And then they have, you know, big ass cars. You know,
oh, yeah. Well,
trucks.
Rail only gives them a partial option anyway. If you, I've had lots of students who've lived out on the Waianae Coast, and it's, you know, you could take the wagon train across the prairie in the time it takes to drive in, and they still have to drive in an extensive sort of way. Rail's not going to go anywhere west of where it is now. So it's very hard to do. It's not clear whether people want it. And some of the other suggestions that economists make, and you also can see how hard it is you can change behavior. You can change school schedules. You can change work schedules. That would be real interesting here with people taking their kids all over school with being friends of private schools here.
So, yeah, if it's not flying in New York, you may not fly
no,
here.
No, but it's an intriguing idea to deal with a very serious, costly problem.
All right. Okay. But thank you so much, Neil.
You're welcome.
We've been
taking a car home.
Okay. We've been talking to our contributing editor, Neil Milner. We will have links to the article, as he mentioned, on the conversation page of our website later today. This week, we plan to take a closer look at a number of green energy projects that are getting underway across Hawaii. The state's largest solar project began operating at the end of this past May. The Kuhialani Solar Plus Storage Project is located in central Maui. Officials just announced this week that it's producing 60 megawatts of electricity, enough to power 27,000 homes at the cheapest price. Sandra Larson is the market business leader of AES in Hawaii. She stopped by our studios this morning to talk about the green energy landscape.
Really excited about that coming online. We broke ground in July of 2022. So it's taken a couple of years, and the team has really shown a lot of commitment and dedication and hard work to bring that all online. So really proud of the team and just want to give them a quick shout out here. Congratulations to them.
The fact that it is the largest, I mean, are we going to see more large-scale projects, you know, like this?
Well, I can't speak for other projects, but I do know that for us, we have several projects that are under development currently and that are about to come online. We also have two projects that we were recently awarded through Hawaiian Electric's RFP3, which is, you know, their request for proposal. And one of those projects on the Big Island will be over 80 megawatts. So we are moving forward with large-scale utility projects. You know, they do have a lot of benefit to our communities and help us to get off of fossil fuels and reduce our usage of fossil fuels so that we can become more sustainable and help to reach our 100% renewable energy goals here.
And then what's the timetable for that Big Island facility?
That one is not for several years. We're looking at about 2027 to 2030. So these projects are, you know, it takes a while for them from the development stage, and we're currently still in negotiations with Hawaiian Electric for the power purchase agreement. So there's a process that we have to go through to bring these online. So it's a significant amount of work, and it's really collaborating with the county agencies, with Hawaiian Electric, with community. And so in order for us to get to our goals, it really is about working together and trying to bring these projects on faster.
And the siting of that project on the Big Island, what are the details?
It will be close to our Waikoloa facility, which is currently operational. So Kuihilani just came online. The Maui project will be a phase two of Kuihilani.
Okay, but a little bit smaller?
Yeah, that one is about 40 megawatts. That one, I think, is 2027. So, you know, again, it takes a while because we have to go through the permitting process. So the projects that we'll see pretty soon coming online are two additional projects on Oahu. So we recently just launched our West Oahu project in April of this year. And we have two projects on Oahu that will be coming behind that probably in early 2025. So we're excited for those projects. So we currently have operational projects on the Big Island, on Maui now. Our first one was West Oahu here on Oahu. So really a lot of activity and a lot of work to help support our state's transition.
How do we build up our workforce? Because, you know, we're creating green jobs, but we need a trained workforce. So how are we doing that?
Yeah, so we are working with, it's a program called Good Jobs Hawaii, and the University of Hawaii is helping to shepherd that along with the State Energy Office, and we're part of that coalition. You know, it's looking at creating good jobs in multiple areas, and renewable energy is one of them. So we're working to help think about what is curriculum that we can add to college courses to help develop career pathways, and even earlier at the high school level to try to get students interested and engaged in renewable energy. And then what we've found, for us at least, you know, the unions are able to find a lot of recent, even high school graduates who don't necessarily have experience in the area, you know, go into the field. But for us, there's some experience that's needed. And so there's a gap between recently graduated jobs. To those who can enter the field. So we're looking at creating apprenticeships or trying to work with recent graduates to think about how do we develop something that will allow them to get the training. You know, maybe it's reskilling existing jobs. And so we're working with our team to think about what are the skills that we need most? How do we bridge that gap? I know the state energy office in UH is looking at developing a program called Kama Aina, Come Home. And so looking at college graduates who are working on the mainland or alumni and trying to find ways to help encourage them to come home. I know a lot of kids move away because there's not opportunity here, and that's what we're really working hard to do is bring some of those jobs back, some good paying jobs so that our keiki can stay here and, you know, really become a sustainable community and economy here. And we currently have two interns that came on for the summer. They're college students on the mainland and they want to come home. So they're really interested in learning about all of the aspects of what we're doing. So we've got two college interns for the summer. We're also working, I think I mentioned to you, with Waianae High School and the Sea Rider Productions. They're looking at developing kind of a documentary narrative looking at renewable energy, why it's important for Hawaii, how can we get to our 100% renewable energy goal. So just trying to educate our youth on how important renewable energy is, what type of career pathways are available, and get them excited about what type of opportunities are available in that area, but also to hear the story from their lens. Right. I think it's so important. Our youth are really demanding that we address climate change. And I think it's an opportunity for them to really understand and learn what's needed to get us there.
And then AES closed our last coal plant. But what else does AES have on the horizon? I mean, you know, there's talk about hydrogen. So what's on your landscape?
So in Hawaii, we're primarily focused on solar plus battery storage, but AES is a global company. We're one of the largest renewable energy developers across the world. And so in Texas, we just recently partnered with Air Products. It's a $4 billion project where we are developing the world's first mega-scale hydrogen production, green hydrogen production facility. So that's currently underway. It is, I believe, slated for a 2025 operations. So really looking forward to seeing how that goes. And, you know, it's a really exciting time for the company. I would love to see if we could bring hydrogen to Hawaii. I think, you know, it's not really cost effective for us to do that yet. So I think once we get some expertise in that area, I'd love to have our team look at, you know, what's possible here in Hawaii.
With the big push toward our goals, we really have to speed up our efforts. I mean, I know the state did put in for that grant.
The hydrogen hub.
Yes, yes, the hydrogen hub. And we did not get it, but I understand that some states, yep. I think it's California.
California is one of them. And I know our team is definitely working with organizations there to help with the hub. So that's another area where I'm hoping we can learn from their experience and bring that here as well.
Lots to look forward to. Anything else that you want to underscore just as we look at the different alternate energies this week?
Well, one of the things that I think would be really beneficial to Hawaii and something that we launched recently in partnership with 5B, it's called the 5B Maverick. It's a solar array system that's kind of a accordion style. And so it's a foldable system that can be deployed and then folded up and relocated. So it's the simplest, fastest way to ground mount solar. So that's something that we're talking with our teams about. You know, they're currently installing it in Puerto Rico, and it is designed to withstand hurricane strength winds. And so to me, that's something that could be beneficial here in Hawaii as we are looking at climate change and, you know, more hurricanes coming here. It seems like that might be something that could be really beneficial to be able to quickly install these types of equipment and systems and be able to relocate them as needed. So that's another thing that our team is looking at and I think could be an exciting possibility for Hawaii.
That was Sandra Larson, President and Market Business Leader for AES Hawaii. The company has been operating in the islands for more than 30 years, and it just announced this week that the state's largest solar project is fully operational on the Valley Isle. It is also behind the Napua Makani Wind Power Project on Oahu's North Shore. The push for alternate energy is due to the impact of the gas and oil industry on climate change. HPR reporter Savannah Herrmann-Pote joins us to talk about the status of a lawsuit that Hawaii filed against major oil producers 4 years ago. It's possible that the U.S. Supreme Court could take up the case later this year. Good morning, Savannah.
Good morning, Catherine.
Yeah, so we're waiting with bated breath. Do we know when the Supreme Court will decide whether or not to take this up?
No, and we may be waiting for a while. The Supreme Court doesn't have necessarily a public timeline on when it announces it's going to hear a case. So early this year, the defendants in this case, Honolulu versus Sunoco, and that includes oil companies like Sunoco, but also Aloha Petroleum and Chevron, filed a petition before the U.S. Supreme Court asking for the highest court in the land to consider the case that had been filed by Honolulu in 2020. Last week, the Supreme Court justices met privately to confer about this case. And then we got another little morsel early this week when the Supreme Court justices asked the U.S. Solicitor General to weigh in on the matter. So we do know that they're likely considering hearing the case because otherwise they wouldn't necessarily ask for counsel from the Biden administration. And if they take the case, it's going to have big implications for what's happening at the state level, Honolulu versus Sunoco, as well as Maui County's case against oil companies. And then at least a dozen other cases that have been filed across different states and municipalities dealing with the same issue. So I wanted to know a little bit more. I spoke with Richard Walsgrove, he's the co-director of the Environmental Law Program at UH Law School, about what really could happen if the Supreme Court does decide to take up Honolulu's case and rules favorably for the defendants.
In one view, this could mean the end of climate litigation. And I say that recognizing that we are really talking about cases that are specifically state tort law cases that are related to climate change only insofar as they're arguing that the extra fuel that was sold because of the deceptive marketing contributed sort of an extra boost to climate change. So it certainly a U.S. Supreme Court decision that decides that there is no role for state tort law in a claim like that, that could mean all of the municipal climate litigation cases that are moving forward across the country in one stroke of the pen are deemed federal issues that states can't take up.
Wow. That's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. And of course, the question that everyone wants to know beyond whether or not the U.S. Supreme Court takes up the case is how would the U.S. Supreme Court rule? And I posed this question to a number of different people who work with matters before the Supreme Court. And they say, you know, at this point, trying to assert how the court will rule is like reading tea leaves. But Richard Walsgrove did say that there are serious concerns about how the court's ruling might affect this case and other climate litigation based on the current political ideology of the court.
The fear that I think that a number of folks have is that with a U.S. Supreme Court that is increasingly viewed as activist and taking up issues based on political preferences, is that they could go even further, and right, a U.S. Supreme Court opinion could say that all climate issues, all issues that relate, no matter how tenuously, to emissions that can cross over state boundaries, are not state tort law issues, which means you have to go back to federal courts for any sort of climate litigation. And we already know that there are severe limits on what you can do with federal law because the Clean Air Act has been ruled to preempt other attempts to regulate interstate emissions.
Yeah, this is just so fascinating.
Mm-hmm. And Richard Walsgrove said that something else to really pay attention to are the actors who are working to put this case before the Supreme Court, who really want the Supreme Court to weigh on this in on this issue. Person who has mounted a really big PR case to get the Supreme Court to take up this case is Leonard Leo. He might be familiar to listeners as part of a conservative coalition that worked to get conservative justices on the Supreme Court and then worked to bring forward the Dobbs decision, the ruling of which by the U.S. Supreme Court overturned the precedent for Roe v. Wade. So there's definitely conservative minds who are really interested in the Supreme Court case, the Supreme Court taking up this case and then dismissing it.
Yeah, I mean, lots of concern over the EPA's, power also being weakened by some recent decisions. But yeah, it really is a kind of a turning point that we could be facing with this.
Absolutely. And we'll certainly be keeping an eye on it. But the timeline, once again, for the Supreme Court deciding to hear this case is uncertain. And it's also uncertain how it might affect the timeline of the trial for the Honolulu versus Sunuko case. So our Supreme Court signed off on a trial last October, but that date hasn't been set either.
All right. Okay. Well, thank you so much, Savannah.
Thank you, Catherine.
We've been hearing from HVR Savannah Harriman-Pote as we wait to see if the U.S. Supreme Court decides to hear a climate change lawsuit filed by the state and city against the gas and oil industry.
I'm Bert Lum. Today on Bite Marks Cafe, we find out what is happening in the evolving world of community television. We'll talk to Olelo Community Media about media literacy, content creation, and the role community television plays in elevating voice. That's this evening at 6:30 on Bite Marks Cafe.
Each week, New Dimensions explores the social, political, scientific, environmental, and spiritual frontiers with some of today's foremost social innovators, thinkers, scientists, and creative artists.
Hi, I'm Alanis Morissette. Next time on New Dimensions, I'll be talking about various versions of service in the world and how we can show up as our truest selves to serve.
Beginning Sunday morning at 11.
Hearings resume today in a legal challenge by Hawaii midwives over a law that they say discriminates against them. HPR reporter Ashley Mizuo was there for opening arguments on Monday and joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning. Yes, yeah, so the case is being brought by 9 different plaintiffs, 6 midwives, 3 mothers, and they're challenging a 2019 state law that requires midwives to get special licensing to operate. The plaintiffs are saying that it makes it virtually impossible for Native Hawaiian cultural practitioners to provide maternal care as traditional midwives and is, in that case, threatening reproductive autonomy in the state. So they're saying that this state law is unconstitutional. And so to get a license, people have to pass through a program accredited by the Midwifery Education Accreditation Council or the North American Registry of Midwives. Both of these are national organizations, and neither specialize in Native Hawaiian cultural practices or offer actual in-person classes in the state, although they do offer some online. But when the state was – when the law was enacted, it included an exemption for this thing called birth attendance, which allowed people to continue to practice midwifery even without a license until mid-2023. And so that was supposed to give the state about 4 years to come up with a new statute that would allow birth practitioners to legally offer maternal care. But the lawmakers did not pass a new law, and instead they just let the exemption lapse. It effectively made it illegal for anyone without that midwifery license to assist mothers during childbirth, and people could face fines as high as $2,000 and up to a year in prison. And the definition of it is incredibly broad. They're even saying technically it would criminalize like mothers or grandmothers who are helping in any type of official capacity. There was a last-ditch effort by Representative Natalia Hussey-Burdick during this session to recall a bill that would have addressed this from the Finance Committee, which would not give it a hearing. This is a highly irregular thing that happened during session to get the bill pulled out of that committee and heard on the floor, but the motion failed. And so there were sit-ins both this session and last session from these midwives to try to convince lawmakers to take a look at this law, but it was unsuccessful. So now they're in court.
And then you were there on Monday as they were laying out their case. What was your sense?
Yeah, I was there in the morning in the very first day. You know, it was very emotional, hugging, crying. You know, for these plaintiffs, it's an incredibly personal thing to be working on. And one of the lead plaintiffs, Ki'i Koho Ohanohano, the lead plaintiff, has been a Native Hawaiian cultural practitioner and midwife for over 20 years on Maui, and she does not have the midwifery license and so has been unable to practice since the exemption expired.
For us as Kanaka, as Hawaiians, to be able to live on our Ainupuna is rare in the first place. But to be able to actually hanau or give birth in these places is very, very rare. But for us as a people, historically, our babies were born in these places. This is where our ancestors come from for hundreds of years prior. So to be able to have our babies in the places and in the ways of our kupuna, our ancestors, is very vital. It's very much about self-determination and autonomy and reclamation of our practices and of that ea.
Yeah, and she says that the demand for her services increased during the COVID-19 pandemic, and that out of the estimated 80 births she performed during that exemption period between 2019 and 2023, only 5 went to the hospital, and all for non-emergent reasons. Mostly, some of the reasons were because, you know, the pain was maybe higher than the mother had originally thought it would be. But I just wanted to add, too, that, you know, rural areas have very little access to maternal care in Hawaii. On Maui, there are only 2 clinics on the island that do OB services. And our colleague, Catherine Quilpactle, did some really powerful reporting on that topic that you can look at hawaiipublicradio.org.
And so what's the bottom line then?
Yeah, so the Deputy Attorney General, Isaac Ikes, argued that the state regulates many different industries to protect the health and well-being of residents, and midwifery is no different.
And midwifery, when practiced improperly, can pose a significant risk of harm to both birth givers and newborn children. By ensuring that people who offer these services have some standard training and education, regulation and licensing can help to reduce that risk.
And his argument is that, you know, the law doesn't ban home births, and it is instead ensuring that those assisting with birth are minimally qualified to do so. The core of his argument is that the state has the right to regulate this profession as it does for doctors, nurses, and beauticians. The plaintiffs are being represented by the Center of Reproductive Rights and the Native Hawaiian Legal Corporation. And so the hearings are expected to continue for the rest of the week.
Okay, all right. So we'll just have to see. Again, very emotional issue for a lot of the midwives that have been practicing in the community. And I know the law school is looking at this for a reproduction rights issue. So
Right, yeah.
Be interesting to see how that plays out. But thank you so much, Ashley.
Thank you.
We've been talking to HBR's Ashley Mizuo. She's been covering a midwifery case that got underway Monday and continues today at Circuit Court. It's now time for this week's Mono Minute. We have the song of the long-lost o'u, thanks to recordings from the Macaulay Library at the Cornell Laboratory of Ornithology. The honey creeper was last spotted on Kauai in 1989 and is presumed to be extinct. Here's University of Hawaii at Hilo biology professor Patrick Hart.
The o'u was once one of the most common of the Hawaiian honey creepers across all the main Hawaiian islands, but was just recently declared extinct by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. It's about 7 inches long, with males having a distinctive bright yellow head and a brownish-green body, while females are duller and without the yellow head. Both sexes use their unusual parrot-like hooked bill to forage on a variety of native forest fruits, such as ieie, ohe mauka, and ohawai. As one of the only frugivorous, or fruit-eating, Hawaiian honeycreepers, they're considered to have played a very important ecological role as seed dispersers across the forest, and would sometimes even venture down into lowland areas to forage on mountain apples, papayas, and other backyard fruits. The sweet, clear song of the male was a people's favorite, and it begins with a few distinctive whistled notes and ends with a series of downward notes known as a trill. Unfortunately, o'u numbers started to drastically decline in the early to middle 20th century, primarily due to mosquito-transmitted disease, and the last o'u were detected on Hawaii Island in 1987 and Kauai in 1989. Because o'u habitat is in dense wet forests not often visited by birdwatchers, there's still hope among optimistic biologists that a few of these birds may still be out there somewhere. In fact, there's been a handful of credible potential sightings in the past few years on the Big Island. New bird detection techniques, such as placing automated recorders across the landscape, or even using eDNA, may help us get an updated answer as to whether the song of the o'u will ever be heard again in our forests. For Hawaii Public Radio, this is Patrick Hart from the UH Hilo Department of Biology.
Support for Manu Minute comes from the Hawaii Audubon Society, connecting the community with the Manu Oku through programs to promote awareness, appreciation, and conservation of the official bird of Honolulu. Learn more at hiaudubon.org.
Well, that does it for us. We have to go now, but up tomorrow, as we will continue looking at a number of green energy projects that are getting underway in the islands, we will hear from the gas company. We do welcome feedback. Call our talkback line, 808-792-8217, or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Find our archive shows online by searching for The Conversation on our website or as a podcast on Spotify, Apple, or Google. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.